Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
Welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Along with Jim Garrity of National Review, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Not really good, bad, and crazy martinis today. We're going to look at the three biggest exchanges from Thursday night's Republican presidential debate in South Carolina. Let's get into the first dust-up, and this one is actually only the clips of one candidate because he pretty much dominated the issue. Neil Cavuto brought up the eligibility issue with Ted Cruz because Donald Trump had brought it up, as he was born in Canada, but to a mother who is an American citizen. And so Cruz's argument, of course, is obviously that makes him a natural-born citizen. A couple of quick clips that convinced a lot of people that Cruz easily won this particular issue in the debate.
You know, back in September, my friend Donald said that he had had his lawyers look at this from every which way. And there was no issue there. There was nothing to this birther issue. Now, since September, the Constitution hasn't changed. But the poll numbers have. At the end of the day, the legal issue is quite straightforward, but I would note that the birther theories that Donald has been relying on, some of the more extreme ones insist that you must not only be born on U.S. soil, but have two parents born on U.S. soil. Under that theory, not only would I be disqualified, Marco Rubio would be disqualified, Bobby Jindal would be disqualified, and interestingly enough, Donald J. Trump would be disqualified.
Not me.
Because Donald's mother was born in Scotland.
Jim, it seems like game, set, match in that exchange, and I'm sure you're doubly happy because Jindal got mentioned.
For one brief shining moment, he was back in the race. I think this may have been one of Cruz's most impressive rhetorical and verbal just presentation moments of this entire campaign, because you could tell he had done his homework backwards and forwards. I mean, the little clip you played there was just, you know, I mean, it's a good thing if he had a hand mic, Greg, he could have dropped it at that moment, right? If you want to do it by that standard, you're not qualified either, Donald. You keep hearing Cruz supporters say, oh, man, our guy is terrific, and if he was up against Hillary, he'd really win that debate. And there are times I kind of wonder, like, well, you know, Ted Cruz really comes across as one of the most brilliant lawyers you'll ever run across. The way I had it described to me by somebody who worked with him is the good news about Ted Cruz is he's the smartest guy in the room. The bad news about Ted Cruz is he has to let you know he's the smartest guy in the room. In this case, the fact that he knew the law, the fact that he knew Donald Trump's own record, the fact that he could point to kind of the opportunism of Donald on this and how the Constitution hadn't changed, but the polling had, man, he just dismantled him. And I think it was if you want to vote against Ted Cruz, the idea that he's some sort of Canadian sleeper agent, or that the Democrats are going to knock him off the ballot and win the 2016 election by default, those are not good reasons. There are better reasons than this. And it was one of the few times I think we've seen Trump really come across as being flummoxed on this. And you just could tell, you know, Trump wings it and Ted Cruz knows his stuff backwards and forwards. And I kind of am intrigued to see how Ted Cruz would handle Hillary Clinton in a debate. We will see how that scenario shakes out. But man, oh man, you want to talk about, score one for the Princeton debate team, because Cruz came into this knowing what he wanted to do and just doing it step by step. I felt like I was watching the bomb squad defuse something and just do it step by step, calmly and methodically.
And he got Trump to admit that it was the polling changes over the past few weeks and months that ultimately triggered his reversal on Cruz's eligibility. But it wasn't the first Cruz-Trump exchange. There was another one a short time later over Cruz's statement over the past few days that Trump embodies New York values, with the implication obviously being that those are not the same as Iowa values or conservative values, perhaps. A lot of people think Trump got the better end of this exchange. A couple of quick Cruz clips and then Trump's response.
But everyone understands that the values in New York City are socially liberal or pro-abortion or pro-gay marriage, focus around money and the media. You know, the concept of New York values is not that complicated to figure out. Not too many years ago, Donald did a long interview with Tim Russert. And in that interview, he explained his views on a whole host of issues that were very, very different from the views he's describing now. And his explanation, he said, look, I'm from New York. That's what we believe in New York. Those aren't Iowa values, but this is what we believe in New York. And so that was his explanation.
But here came the Trump card, if you will.
When the World Trade Center came down, I saw something that no place on earth could have handled more beautifully, more humanely than New York. You had two 110-story buildings come crashing down. I saw them come down. Thousands of people killed. And the cleanup started the next day, and it was the most horrific cleanup probably in the history of doing this and in construction. I was down there, and I'd never seen anything like it. And the people in New York fought and fought and fought, and we saw more death and even the smell of death. Nobody understood it, and it was with us for months, the smell, the air. And we rebuilt downtown Manhattan. And everybody in the world watched, and everybody in the world loved New York and loved New Yorkers. And I have to tell you, that was a very insulting statement.
Jim, a lot of people think Trump, just in tone and even content and on a lot of answers, gave his best debate performance by far on Thursday night. That answer, I think, is the one that was at the top of the heap.
Yeah, and I think it's worth, you know, my record of being critical of Trump is pretty well established. I think that was probably his best moment in his campaign. Trump, when he doesn't shout, when he's not being boisterous, when he's not, you know, kind of giving this, hey, look at me. As Haley had said in the response to the State of the Union, sometimes you actually get people to listen with a quieter tone. Of all the reasons, just as, you know, birtherism is a dumb way to go against Ted Cruz, saying, well, he's from New York and you know how those people are, is probably the dumbest possible attack you could make on Donald Trump when there are so many other more fruitful avenues of criticism. And among the issue with Donald Trump is not really that he's from New York or he's got New York values or he's got New York style. The problem with Donald Trump is that he's Donald Trump, right? Don't pin his flaws onto New York City as a whole. And the other thing that kind of stuck out at me, and again, for a candidate who's been very smart so far, this was a really boneheaded move on Cruz's part. Besides all the Americans in New York, the greater New York area, you know, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, lots of people have relatives in New York. Lots of people have traveled to New York. They've gone to see the Statue of Liberty. They may have gone to see Ground Zero. They may have gone to watch a show on Broadway or go to Central Park, do any of the things that people do when they go to New York. And so I'm just kind of left scratching my head why Cruz seemed to think that this is going to work. And the idea that you could say, well, I'll say this in Iowa, but I won't make this point closer. It was kind of just ham-handed. And I think that just as maybe nobody expected how thoroughly and effectively Cruz would dismantle the attack from Trump, I think we were all very pleasantly surprised at how effectively Trump dismantled this attack from Cruz.
Yeah, definitely an interesting exchange. And it turns out Cruz was involved in the third exchange as well, this one about immigration, which came very late in the debate, actually outside of prime time. Maria Bartiromo asked Marco Rubio a question about why he continues to favor allowing people from other countries into the United States when there are so many people in this country who are having a difficult time finding good jobs. And that ultimately triggered a pretty fierce exchange between Rubio and Cruz.
So your thinking has changed.
The issue is a dramatically different issue than it was 24 months ago. 24 months ago, 36 months ago, you did not have a group of radical crazies named ISIS who were burning people in cages and recruiting people to enter our country legally. They have a sophisticated understanding of our legal immigration system.
Radical Islamic terrorism was not invented 24 months ago. 24 months ago, we had Al-Qaeda, we had Boko Haram, we had Hamas, we had Hezbollah, we had Iran putting operatives in South America and Central America. It's the reason why I stood with Jeff Sessions and Steve King and led the fight to stop the Gang of Eight amnesty bill.
You used to say you supported doubling the number of green cards. Now you say that you're against it. You used to support a 500% increase in the number of guest workers. Now you say that you're against it. You used to support legalizing people that were here illegally. Now you say you're against it. You used to say that you were in favor of birthright citizenship. Now you say that you are against it.
And then Rubio went on to even mention some issues unrelated to immigration where he accused Cruz of flip-flopping, and then Cruz came back and saying, I actually supported that issue that you just spoke about because I voted for your amendment. It was about military spending. So, Jim, especially with the laundry list of alleged flip-flops, a lot of folks think Rubio won that exchange. It just seems to me that the more both of those guys talk about immigration, the less good they look.
I was kind of struck by this last night because I generally think well of Rubio, but I have a very hard time believing that this is not good. His position on the Gang of Eight is not going to come back and really be a huge problem for him as the primary goes on. That ultimately, the Republican base loathes the Gang of Eight legislation with a passion. They have a lot of good reasons to do that. And all of Rubio's excuses for it basically amount to, well, I got taken. You know, I didn't think it was going to be that bad. He effectively had to flip-flop into that. He tore into Ted Cruz with his flip-flopping afterwards on all kinds of topics from, you know, raising the number of H-1B visas to crop insurance. But I don't know if you noticed, Greg, when he said, and you flip-flopped on crop insurance, there's this big, like, roar from the crowd. I didn't know that, you know, inconsistency on crop insurance was a really big deal down there in Charleston, South Carolina. But mom and dad were in the audience for that last night, so maybe they were the ones applauding for it. I don't know. But so here's the thing. Like, if you're Marco Rubio and you have a position that is just fundamentally unpopular with the base, how far does you're a flip-flopper against your accuser take you? I'm just kind of left with my scratching my head there. Nonetheless, I mean, Rubio had a very good night. I don't feel like he's diffused it. I kind of feel like he's dodged a bullet twice, in the sense that the first time he was able to get into this, you know, point out that Cruz introduced an amendment for path to legalization, and Cruz keeps insisting, no, I only did that as a poison pill to demonstrate to that the Democrats were not willing to compromise on this. And then he did it with this one, and it's gotten him, you know, through it okay twice. I just kind of feeling that at some point there's going to be one other moment of reckoning for Rubio and the Gang of Eight bill, and it didn't happen last night. I have a suspicion that perhaps in some future debate it will happen. And the other thing is the exchange you're playing there, Greg, that was after 11 o'clock. Maybe the West Coasters liked it, but man, oh man, Fox Business, can we get these things, wrap things up a little bit faster? You know, if you watched the, once again, if you watched the pre-debate, you had more than 3.5 hours of debate to watch. And I think even for most political junkies, that's a really big time commitment to ask for.
Yeah, and then 2 hours in between debates. That was a little rough, too. But ultimately, does the needle move much? I mean, a lot of folks think all the top three candidates did themselves well, if not some may have done better than others. But ultimately, pretty good reviews for Trump, Cruz, and Rubio.
Elsewhere, my colleague Eliana Johnson and Tim Alberta say it's a four-person race, and they put Christie in there. And I'm kind of like, eh. I guess he does very well in New Hampshire, and that'll boost him up to that top tier. It's kind of hard to, it's very easy to believe that if Christie does particularly well in New Hampshire, that maybe he knocks, you know, Rubio out of that top tier. Unless your name is Trump, Cruz, or Rubio, you really, it was like, oh yeah, you're still in the race. It was kind of the tone to last night. And they would go long stretches before they went to Ben Carson. I don't know about you, Greg. Kasich struck me as the national bathroom break. Just kind of get up, get a drink, do whatever else you need to do. Christie had his entertaining moments, and Jeb Bush had a nice enough night, but he's doing so badly, it's kind of hard to see how it's a game changer. So, yeah, it looks like a three-person debate, and at some point when it comes down to those three, you could really see a fascinating and, I think, very pugnacious fight over what the Republican Party should stand for.
Yeah, obviously, I think at this point folks are going to stay in to see what the first votes look like. But, Jim, you said it exactly right. Based on the way the debate unfolded on Thursday night, it seems like there's really three people involved with a legit shot at this nomination. Jeb mixed it up a little, Christie a little more. Kasich and Carson absolutely just seem to be afterthoughts in this thing. And for those two in particular, this quote from Ferris Bueller back in the 80s seemed to ring true.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
You know, they got to make their own decision to get out of the race, but that's kind of how I was viewing Carson and Kasich last night.
Yeah, and also for that matter, you know, you don't want to be mean, but, you know, the undercard debate. the irony is that you watch those other candidates, and they all have the same persona. And in the case of Carly Fiorina, I find it very appealing, but it just hasn't taken off for her. And you got to wonder, okay, well, when is it going to turn, you know, to take off? For Santorum and for Huckabee, you know, these guys won Iowa. He cycles back. They know who you are. They just, for whatever reason, they're just not buying it this time around. And you got to wonder at some point, do they say, okay, at least after, you know, after Iowa, isn't it reasonable to say, okay, guys, it's not working for you. Time to hang it up.
I think we may see that, at least with one of those guys after Iowa, if the numbers don't change dramatically over the next 2.5 weeks. But we will wait and see. So, Jim, we've got 6 Republican debates in the book now. I think that's the last one before Iowa, correct?
I believe you are correct, Greg, yes.
Wow, so real votes before the next debate. Amazing. Jim, have a great weekend. Hope the Patriots lose, and we'll talk to you on Monday.
See you Monday, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. Have a great weekend, everyone. Join us Monday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.